So we're still in the book of Proverbs, and what we're doing is we are talking about how the wisdom books in the Bible are structured and how they encode wisdom. So what we did the first time is we talked about the one-line poem and talked about how those are unpacked. Last time we went through Proverbs on wealth and showed how they appear on the surface to be contradictory but really aren't. And what I asserted last time, and the time before actually, is that it is also possible to take these one-line poems and stack them to make an argument. The one-line poem, the Mashal, is a nugget of wisdom all of its own and is designed to be discussed and pondered, and it's also designed to be memorized. So it serves as a very compact way of encoding knowledge so that it can be passed down from generation to generation. But in order to understand it, you've got to know what the code is. That's what we've been talking about, is what the code is so that you can figure this out. Now, as I say, each mashal is typically worthy of thought and discussion by itself, but it is also possible to group them so that they form an argument or a larger lesson or something like that. And I've got as many as 4 examples of that tonight. We'll go through as many of them as seems good. I think I would rather start with Proverbs 23. The first 8 verses are what I am describing. Proverbs 9, the whole chapter, is what I'm describing, but that's sort of a standard chiasm. Proverbs 23 is also a chiasm, so I'm going to read the first 8 verses of Proverbs 23, and then we can come back and unpack it. So, Proverbs 23. When you sit down to eat with a ruler, observe carefully what is before you, and put a knife to your throat if you are given to appetite. Do not desire his delicacies, for they are deceptive food. Do not toil to acquire wealth. Be discerning enough to desist. When your eyes light on it, it is gone, for suddenly it sprouts wings, flying like an eagle toward heaven. Do not eat the bread of a man who is stingy. Do not desire his delicacies, for he is like one who is inwardly calculating. Eat and drink, he says to you, but his heart is not with you. You will vomit up the morsels that you have eaten and waste your pleasant words. That is a chiasm. At the beginning and at the end, you are eating with someone who is in a better station than you are. In the first case, you're eating with a ruler, and in the second case, you are eating with someone who is stingy, but has invited you to eat with him for his own purposes. And then in the middle of that, it's talking about wealth. So you have, we're dining with powerful people, beginning and end, and talking about wealth in the middle. So the question that I would ask, you may have other questions, but the one that occurs to me is, what is your focus as you are sitting down to eat in each case? Not what should it be, but what is it? What are you being warned against? And what I'm suggesting to you is the thing that you are warned against is the thing that would be the most natural for you to do. In both cases, what's happening here is you are eating a meal with someone who is in a position to do you a favor, is in a position to advance you socially, is in a position to get you wealth, is in a position to do you good somehow. So as you're sitting there, your natural inclination is, what am I going to get out of this social occasion that is going to benefit me? And it talks about it in terms of wealth. It could be power, it could be anything. So your natural inclination is, you're sitting there in this place where you have powerful and prominent and wealthy people, is what's in it for me? What you're neglecting here, and it doesn't say so in the case of the king, but it definitely says so at the end, is the person that you're eating with also has an agenda. And that agenda becomes clear when we're talking about the stingy man. And he is inwardly calculating. So what he's calculating, if he offers up this delicious food to you, he's calculating, all right, what's the bill at the end of the meal? So the ruler is also calculating then. The ruler may not be calculating about money, but the ruler is probably calculating about power. So you have calculations on both sides. The host has got his calculations going, and you've got the guest, you, have your calculations going. And what the proverb is warning you about is keep a rein on your desires. So it talks in terms of gluttony here. It says, don't grab everything on the table and stuff it into your face. Well, that's probably not what's being talked about. What's being talked about is don't reach out and try and grab everything that is potentially there at this dinner party. So you're having dinner with the king. At the end of it, say, hey, king, how about making me a duke? That would be within his power to do. But what would appear to him is this guy's just calculating what he's after. In the case of the stingy man, as you eat his food, your temptation may be hit him up for a loan or any number of other things. You see the calculations that could be going on at this dinner party. And the metaphor here is gluttony. You see all these wonderful foods on the table. Don't be grabbing everything and trying to eat it. What it's really saying is two things. One, if you grab everything and try and eat it, you will be looked upon as a boor and a glutton, which means that you'll reduce your standing socially in this mixture. What you want to do is you want to act like these kind of dinners are places I go all the time. It's no big deal in both cases. One, in the case of the king, you behave that way so that he sees you as a higher class person as opposed to somebody who has gotten in there by accident and has got eyes this big and is trying to eat everything. Well, I mean, if you behave that way, very clearly you are not of his class. In the case of the stingy man, if you do that, what he's doing is he's adding up the bill. And he's saying, all right, this guy now owes me whatever. And so in both of these cases, it tells you how to behave in the presence of powerful people, both socially and from an expectation perspective. Again, another proverb, if you will, is when you go to a banquet, don't rush up to the head table and sit down. Sit in the back of the room. And then if you are worthy of being in the head table, your host will ask you to come up and sit at the head table. Same kind of things. But the point I'm making here is not so much the lesson in the proverb, is to show you how these things can be stacked so that each one of them is worthy of discussion by itself, but the total of all of them adds up to a bigger picture. That's the object of the exercise here. That's the first example, and it's very clear, and it's very worthy of unpacking. So pick it up in three. Do not desire his delicacies, for they are deceptive food. In other words, they aren't going to give you what they would appear to give you on the surface. They're deceptive. And then, don't toil to acquire wealth. Oh, well, that's why his delicacies are deceptive, is because you are looking at them as, this is something that will make me rich. And what he's saying is, no, it won't, because wealth in that case is flighty, and as soon as you try and reach out and grab it, it will fly away. If you're reading it without being aware of the bigger picture, each one of those is worth talking about. So now let's go to Proverbs 9, and we're going to be doing the whole chapter. Proverbs 9 is also a chiasm. So what you have are two women. Wisdom, who is personified as feminine in the Proverbs, and you have the woman of folly. They each basically have the same conversation. They say the same thing. And in the middle is the wisdom, if you will, that is being talked about, and what you are going to wisdom to avoid, and what you are fleeing from folly to avoid, because folly will lead you into the things in the middle that are negative. Wisdom will lead you out. So chapter 9, Proverbs. Wisdom has built her house. She has hewn her seven pillars. She has slaughtered her beast. She has mixed her wine. She has also set her table. She has sent out her young women to call from the highest places in the town. Whoever is simple, let him turn in here. To him who lacks sense, she says, come, eat of my bread, and drink of the wine I have mixed. Leave your simple ways and live, and walk in the way of insight. So she is being portrayed here as a seductive woman. She has set everything up so that you should want to go to her house. And furthermore, she's broadcasting her invitation all over town. And specifically, she's looking for people who are simple. Simple in biblical terms here doesn't mean what simple means in our language. Today, someone who is simple is typically mentally defective, whereas naive would be probably a better word. The whole idea is this is aimed primarily at young men, and young men, until they get some sense and some experience, are simple, unwise, fools, none of which is necessarily evil. Simply, that's what goes with being a young man. And the whole purpose of Proverbs, of course, is to educate you out of it. So now let's go down to verse 13, who is the other woman. The woman folly is loud. She is seductive and knows nothing. She sits at the door of her house. She takes a seat in the highest places of the town, calling to those who pass by, who are going straight on their way. Whoever is simple, let him turn in here. And to him who lacks sense, she says, stolen water is sweet, and the bread eaten in secret is pleasant. But he does not know that the dead are there, and her guests are in the depths of Sheol. So the two situations are almost mirror images of each other. Wisdom has sent her women, maidservants, if you will, out into the city to invite the simple to come. The brassy woman, folly, is not sending anybody out. She herself is sitting at the gates and raising a ruckus and saying, come on, all you simple people. Her bait, if you will, is stolen water, things that are sinful, guilty pleasures, if you will. Whereas wisdom is come and feast in my house, and that will be pleasant enough. And in the process, you will leave your simple ways and you will walk in the way of insight. So the woman folly is offering guilty pleasures, and the woman wisdom is offering the fruits of knowledge. You see how the two are just exactly mirrored of each other. So then in the middle, we have verse 7 through 12, and that, if you look at it from wisdom's point of view, she's warning you. If you look at it from folly's point of view, what you're seeing is the behavior of a fool. Starts off with verse 7. Whoever corrects a scoffer gets himself abuse. And he who reproves a wicked man incurs injury. Okay, so this is now worthy of discussion all by itself. So what we're talking about is first a scoffer. And a scoffer, of course, is one who, when he hears wisdom, mocks, scoffs at it. It's virtue is its own reward kind of thing. And you say virtue is its own reward, you say, yeah, I'll take the other. It's a scoffing attitude. A scoffer, by definition, thinks he knows better. So what will happen if you correct a scoffer is he will abuse you. And if you reprove a wicked man, he will get violent. So the first one of these mashalim, if you will, talks about attitude. And it gives a piece of wisdom, first off, as you're coming in there, young man. There's another proverb that says, like a man who grabs a dog by his ears is someone who enters into a quarrel not his own, which is to say, if you grab a dog by his ears, you're going to get bit. So if you interfere in somebody else's quarrel, you're going to get bit. What this says is, when you are around the scoffer or the wicked, don't bother, because it isn't going to do any good, and it may get you injured. Verse 8, do not reprove a scoffer. Notice here we have whoever corrects a scoffer. Now it says, do not reprove a scoffer, or he will hate you. Reprove a wise man, and he will love you. So this is A prime, B, B prime, parallel. And so again, you have a scoffer, and if you pull a scoffer up short, he will wind up hating you. He won't change. But if a wise man is doing something that is unwise, and you say, whoa, whoa, that's not a good idea, he will say, thank you. And oh, by the way, the other thing that says to us then is, if you're going to be wise, when someone corrects you, how do you behave? See how all this works? Verse 9, give instruction to a wise man, and he will be still wiser. Teach a righteous man, and he will increase in learning. So first thing back in verse 8, we had reproving a wise man. In other words, a wise man is either making or is about to make a mistake, and you say, that's wrong. Don't do that. That's reproof. Giving instruction is not necessarily situation dependent. In other words, it's not the case that he is about to run off the rails. You are simply teaching him something. And with the wise and the righteous, when you teach them things, they will become better. As opposed to a scoffer, when you try and teach him something, he will not become better because he won't pay any attention to you. Comment was, one of the things that says is you are never completely wise. You always have room to learn something. And recognizing that you always have something to learn keeps you open to learning and is also a trait of the wise. Verse 10, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the Holy One is insight. Notice that the fear of the Lord is just the beginning of wisdom. It puts you on the path. It gets your feet on the trail. It is not in itself wisdom. You're going to have work to do for the rest of your life as you go along. And then knowledge of the Holy One is insight. Now, what might that mean? Well, what's insight? Literally means seeing into something, seeing something inside of something else that is below the surface. The whole worldview of the wise in biblical literature is that God has created a system that can be understood. And if you're going to understand it, you need to start knowing God, because as you learn his character, you will develop insights into things he has done. In the 18th and 19th centuries, where we had the great gentleman scientists, you know, Boyle and Isaac Newton and so forth, these typically were guys that were aristocrats and had their own source of income, and the thing they were interested in was science. The explicit attitude of those people was, by studying God's creation, we will be able to infer more about God. For example, if you were to look at a chair, you can infer something about people. We bend at the waist, like to lean back against something. You can infer all sorts of things about people by looking at a chair. So the attitude of the 18th and 19th century scientists, this is before Darwin, was let's study this creation, and in that we will gain insight into the nature of God. This is saying much the same thing. When it says, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, in other words, once you recognize that there is God and you respect Him as God, your feet are now on the path. And as you learn about God, knowledge of the Holy One, as you learn about God, you will then have insight into the world He created. The comment was that the Septuagint translates knowledge of the Holy One as knowledge of the saints. In other words, those people who are also godly will have learned things and you will learn from them. I don't have any problem with that. I like my translation better, though. Let me read 10 and 11, since 11 is a continuation. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and the knowledge of the Holy One is insight. For by me, your days will be multiplied, and years will be added to your life. Who is me? Wisdom. And I'm reading another one of Kugel's books. And he's talking about early commentators on the Bible, starting in probably the 5th century BC. A lot of commentary is written on the Bible. And they look at Genesis 1 and says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. But in Proverbs, it says, by wisdom, God created the heavens and the earth. Wait a minute. It says here in the beginning, and here it says by wisdom. So they must say the beginning must be wisdom. And there are translations of the Bible that say that. It was apparently a fairly influential perspective. And then verse 12, if you are wise, you are wise for yourself. If you scoff, you alone will bear it. And notice now we're back to scoffers. So what wisdom is doing is saying, come, I have made this wonderful meal for you to have. All you simple ones, come and enjoy my feast. And in that process, then, it is telling them that the first thing that you have to get rid of is scoffing and skepticism. Folly, on the other hand, is luring you toward guilty pleasures, and folly is encouraging you then to scoff. Because by scoffing, you have shut the door to wisdom. Remember, it says, scoffer won't listen to you. The scoffer will hate you. The scoffer will abuse you. So what folly wants to do is make sure that you stay a scoffer, because that will shut you out from gaining wisdom. So that's example number two. So the next one I want to do, let's take a look at Proverbs 16, the first 9 verses there. This is a little more obscure. The first two that we went through are, I think, pretty straightforward when you know what you're looking for. This is a little more obscure. So I'm going to read the first 9 verses. The plans of the heart belong to man, but the answer of the tongue is from the Lord. All the ways of a man are pure in his own eyes, but the Lord weighs the spirit. Commit your work to the Lord, and your plans will be established. The Lord has made everything for its purpose, even the wicked for the day of trouble. Everyone who is arrogant in heart is an abomination to the Lord. Be assured, he will not go unpunished. By steadfast love and faithfulness, iniquity is atoned for, and by the fear of the Lord, one turns away from evil. When a man's ways please the Lord, he makes even his enemies be at peace with him. Better is a little with righteousness than great revenue with injustice. The heart of man plans his way, but the Lord establishes his steps. So you start off with the plans of the heart, and it ended with the plans of the heart. So in between, not quite a chiasm. You know, plans of the heart belong to man, but the answer to the tongue is from the Lord. In other words, how did God create everything? By speaking. So the plans of the heart belong to man, but the answer of the tongue is from the Lord. In other words, the Lord's word is final on this, whatever you're planning. And all the ways of man are pure in his own eyes, but the Lord weighs the spirit. So we have the plans of the heart belong to a man, and then the ways of that man are pure in his own eyes. He thinks he's doing what's right. But the Lord will weigh the spirit. And what I think that means myself is you may be doing the right thing for the wrong reason. So for example, if you are in a society that values charity, you may decide to give charity in order to increase your social standing and in order to get yourself into a better class of neighborhood or in order to increase your own wealth. You're not giving it because you're generous. You're giving it for your own benefit. Now, giving it for your own benefit is better than not giving it at all. Don't get me wrong. But the point here is, in your eyes, your ways are pure, but in God's eyes, they may not be. So then commit your work to the Lord and your plans will be established. All right, now we're back to plan. So the plans of the heart belong to man. And he says here, commit your work to the Lord and he will establish your plans. Remember, the answer of the tongue is from the Lord. So if you want the Lord involved in your plans, commit your way to him and he will then establish it. And oh, by the way, he will also alter your plans for you and you'll be happy about it. Verse 4, the Lord has made everything for its purpose, even the wicked for the day of trouble. The idea here is the Lord is the one who made it all, and it all has meaning. So as you're making your plans, what you want to do is you want to reflect on the plans and the meaning that the Lord has established. Okay, remember, we heard said earlier that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and knowledge of the Holy One is insight. Verse 5. Everyone who is arrogant in heart is an abomination to the Lord. Be assured he will not go unpunished. Back up in the beginning, the plans of the heart. We're still talking about the plans of the heart. So someone who is arrogant in heart is refusing to alter or make his plans in light of the wisdom of God. He wants to do it his own way. Verse 6, by steadfast love and faithfulness, iniquity is atoned for. And by the fear of the Lord, one turns away from evil. So I am suggesting to you that everybody periodically makes plans that are not pleasing to God, simply because we're human. So what do when you do that and you get corrected? You repent. Steadfast love and faithfulness, iniquity is atoned for. In other words, I made a wrong plan. I stepped out on the wrong plan. I realized I was wrong. God allows you to atone for that and correct. And you do that because you fear the Lord. And that will get you to turn away from the evil plan that you perhaps have made. Verse 7, when a man's ways please the Lord, he makes even his enemies to be at peace with him. Fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. So as you're trying to adjust your way to please the Lord, you will find that you will get benefits in other places that you don't expect. You don't expect your enemies to be at peace with you. God can make that happen. Verse 8, better is a little with righteousness than great revenues with injustice. And I am suggesting to you back here in the plans of the heart could very well be economic. Remember, one of the things that it says is don't say we're going to go to this city or that city and we're going to trade for a year and we're going to come back with great profit. Say instead, if the Lord wills, we are going to do this. So I'm assuming that one of the things about the plans of the heart are schemes to get rich. So better is a little with righteousness than great revenues with injustice. If the only way you can get great revenue is by plans that don't please God, it isn't worth it. And then finally, the end of the sequence, the heart of a man plans his ways, but the Lord establishes his steps. And we're back up to where we were at the beginning. There's sort of a flip comment that wisdom comes from experience. Experience comes from lack of wisdom. So the last one, let's do Proverbs 22, 17 through 21. Incline your ear and hear the words of the wise, and apply your heart to my knowledge. For it will be pleasant if you keep them within you, if all of them are ready on your lips. That your trust may be in the Lord, I have made them known to you today, even to you. Have I not written for you 30 sayings of counsel and knowledge, to make you know what is right and true, that you may give a true answer to those who sent you? This obviously is instruction of a father to a son. And the first one is, listen to what I say, but also apply your heart to it. Which is to say, don't just listen, think. Think about what I've said. And if you do, it will be pleasant for you, if you keep them, if all of them are ready to your lips. In other words, memorize them. These things are set up for easy memorization. That's the whole purpose of the one-line poem. They are designed to be memorized. That your trust may be in the Lord, I have made them known to you today, even to you. In other words, all of this, by the way, is not only human wisdom, it is also spiritual wisdom, because all of them talk with reference to God. Again, as I said earlier, the world view of the wise is God made everything. He made it so we can understand it. He made it consistent. So as you study human wisdom, understand that there is a plan behind that, and you can figure that plan out. Verse 20, have I not written for you 30 sayings of counsel and knowledge to make you know what is right and true, that you may give a true answer to those who sent you? What do you suppose that means? I can think of several things it might be. Obviously, it isn't crystal clear, otherwise there wouldn't be any room for discussion. One is, of course, the ones who sent you into the world are your parents. And so as you come back, you can give them a true answer, which is to say, you can show them that you have increased in wisdom. The same could be said if God was the one who sent you. The same could be said if you are a herald or a messenger for somebody important. So if you get sent off to do something by somebody important, the king or whoever you ate dinner with, when you come back, you will have wise things to say in response to whatever you were set out to do. Could be any of those things. Could be something else entirely. And the idea here is these are supposed to engender discussion. But the reason I picked this particular set is when you have a stack of these one-line poems that form a conversation. Question was, what were the 30 sayings we're talking about? It may be apocryphal. I told you 1,000 times, it may be something like that. I don't otherwise know. The goal of starting this was to describe how to decode this stuff. I hope that goal has been achieved, but if you now want to go and decode some of it together, we can do that too. I'm happy to. And if we decide to do that, you all got to come back with something you want to decode. So you don't have to decide for 2 weeks. So give it some thought. And I'm happy to do either one.